Le rendement de temps passé.
May I please report, Mr. David Stagner will present argument for petition.
If it please the court, this case is what was bound to happen sooner or later in the aftermath of this court's landmark decision in Houston, Sagandore. I'm sure the court will remember in that case, this court held that on an open account, the charging, unless there was otherwise agreed by the parties, that an open account only allowed interest at the rate of 6% per annum beginning January 1st following the year in which the purchases were made of the goods delivered. The gravamen of this case is whether or not there was an agreement to pay interest. If there isn't an agreement to pay interest, as I understand the law, then the maximum permissible interest rate is 10%. In this case, there's no question that the charge was 12%. So what we're really talking about is if there is an agreement to pay interest between the parties, then Biozyme Enterprises is guilty of charging usurious interest, but they're not guilty of charging double the amount allowed by law. And under Article 5069, 106, as it existed at that time, of course, it's since been amended by our legislature, the penalties were substantially more severe if you charge double or more than double the amount of interest allowed by law. The facts of this case are relatively clear and undisputed. Ken Vanderhoof had a business. He started back in 1975, and he started buying feed, animal feed, from Biozyme Enterprises from their plant in St. Joseph, Missouri. He would call up to St. Joseph, Missouri, and say, send me 500 pounds of such and such feed, or whatever. To accept this contract, Biozyme Enterprises would deliver the goods. The testimony and the record, which is less than 100 pages, shows that along with the goods, they sent an invoice, and this invoice merely said charge. It's very important to note that the invoice that was delivered along with the goods or shortly after the goods arrived contained no statement regarding interest. This continued, this relationship continued, the buying and whatever, until, well, let me back up. After each month, they did send a monthly statement reflecting the status of this account. At the bottom of the monthly statement was a notation that said to the effect that if the accounts aren't paid within 30 days, 1% per month service charge or finance charge is imposed. Even though this legend was on the bottom of their monthly statement, the first interest charge was not made until a number of months after the first purchase. I believe the first purchase was in April of 75, and the first interest charge was actually imposed in August of 75, even though there had been a balance on the account. In November, Mr. Vanderhoof notified them that he was incorporating. They changed their billing to Preston Farm and Ranch Supply, which is his corporation. In March of 1976 was the last time he bought any goods. They filed a suit in September. This case was tried in February of 1978 and was taken under advisement by the trial court for 2 years because this Houston Sagandore case was, this is what was all that was happening. As a matter of fact, I don't know if it's of importance, but it's ironic. I believe this court decided Houston Sagandore January 23rd, 1979, and the judgment in this case was signed about 10 days later. The lower court in the judgment found that there was an agreement to pay interest, and therefore, Biozyme, even though they charged usurious interest, didn't charge more than twice the amount by law, by finding that there was an express agreement. Our appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals in Dallas was based upon insufficient and no evidence points. We believed at that time, we believe now, that the record simply does not support that finding. The testimony of Mr. Vanderhoof, as it appears in the record, is uncontradicted. He didn't know what the charges were. He didn't know about the interest charges. They asked him on page 33 of the record, question, do you know how much money you owed at the time the notice was given that you wanted the name changed to Preston Farm and Ranch Supply? And his answer was, the only thing I had was what my bookkeeper told me. They asked him, do you think the numbers were right? In other words, the account was right. He said, I believe they are. I would have to go over with my bookkeeper because I'm not a bookkeeper and I knew nothing about it. And again, this testimony is uncontradicted from anybody from Biodesign Enterprises. Asked him about the account again on page 35. His answer is, well, I didn't know what the interest was. In fact, it was all turned over to my bookkeeper. Asked him finally, did you get these monthly statements? Did you get these invoices? And he said, well, I say they were received. I don't really know, but I think they were received. As I said, my bookkeeper has all of it, and Mr. Stagner has a copy of her record. There was nothing in the record would indicate that when these contracts were entered into, that anyone said, okay, Vanderhoof, if you don't pay this, there's going to be a service charge. Biodesign Enterprises, unquestionably under the record, attempted to make a unilateral charge after the contract was executed. The Court of Civil Appeals, in affirming the trial court's judgment, did on a different basis. In the opinion, Judge Carver wrote, we affirm on the grounds that under Section 2.207 of the Texas Business Commerce Code, a seller's additional terms included in the monthly statement imposing a service charge become a part of the contract of the party unless the buyer objects within a reasonable time. Your Honors, I submit that the instruments in this case do not fall within the type of instruments contemplated by Section 2.207. First of all, under the express language of 2.207, and of course, it's what the academians call a battle of the form. Its whole design is so that if Joe Smith orders 100 widgets from a widget company and they write back and say, we accept your order, we will ship only red ones, that unless he calls them back and says, no, I want blue, yellow, and green ones, he's accepted the order, even though under the common law that difference in acceptance would have been a rejection of the offer and a counteroffer. It was for very minor terms. But even under 2.207, our Texas statute provides, as does the uniform rule, that the additional, first of all, it covers only additional or different terms, must be contained in a seasonable expression of acceptance or written confirmation. When Biodesign Enterprises, in this case, sent its monthly statement, the contract was executed. The order was placed, the offer was made, it was accepted by shipment. Simple unilateral contract. It was all over. I submit that this attempted unilateral change in the contract by Biodesign Enterprises or by any other merchant cannot be justified under Section 2.207.
Would you give us your comments about the comment to comment 6 of the UCC book? Yes. On Section 2.207?
Yes, Your Honor, I will. I believe what you're referring to is the comment under 2.207, which says additional terms that may not materially alter the bargain are interest on the account if the interest is within the trade practice, within the amount of trade practice. The problem with that is here unquestionably, and counsel for Biozyme Enterprises does not argue otherwise, they charge usurious interest. Too much allowed by law, violated the law. And I submit that as a matter of law, that can't be trade practice in Texas. We can't say that our merchants, as a matter of practice, violate the law. I submit that per se, that a charge that is usurious is not within the normal trade practice.
Certainly, this counsel, as I recall, Mr. Vanderhoff Incorporated is Preston Farm.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the legal rate is the head of 18, and the video was bought after that. Now, was it sold to Preston Farm or to both? And if it sold to both, what's the interest rate?
Your Honor, I think it was charged to Preston Farm and Ranch Supply after November 1975. The problem is, and the reason that we believe Mr. Vanderhoof is entitled to full relief is that when this suit was brought, they charged both parties with it. In other words, even though the invoices after November of 75 were made out to Preston Farm and Ranch Supply, the Biozyme Enterprises in its original petition, which was a petition they went to trial on, alleged that the amount plus this interest was owed by Vanderhoof and Preston Farm Ranch Supply for the whole length of time. So even though I think that's a charging under our statute.
It's a little difficult for me mechanically to work that out. The corporation recovers the full debt without the penalty. Right? How does it work out?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Well, as I understand it, the corporation can be charged up to 18%. It was charged 12%. So no problem. So the corporation sues on the debt, it recovers the debt in full without offset. The corporation is also Mr. Vander's proof, or whatever his name is. And as to him, the interest is usurious.
Well,
what happens between the corporation and Mr. Vanderhoof in this situation?
Well, I suppose you're talking about Preston Farm and Ranch Supply?
Yeah, Preston Farm.
Well, they're two separate entities.
So Mr. Vanderhoof is a corporation, assuming he was still a stockholder, I don't know if he's not.
I don't think it makes any difference. If Biozyme Enterprise is a separate legal entity, it's entitled to protection of the law regardless of whether, or it has the same duties regardless of whether it has one shareholder or is General Motors. I think
Does Esteller get a judgment against Preston Farms?
Yes, sir.
And then the individual gets a bigger judgment against the seller?
Yes, sir.
That's what you're saying.
Yes, and of course, since they're separate legal entities, there wouldn't be offset. I wouldn't. The monthly statement is, I think, misconstrued by the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals in that the purpose of the monthly statement is not to add new or additional terms to the contract. It's just a statement sent by the seller to reflect the status of the account. How much is owed, how much has been paid, what new materials have been ordered. In Bender UCC Guide, they have an interesting discussion when New York adopted the Uniform Commercial Code, and they discussed, it's not in the brief, but they discussed briefly what instruments, what writings could be writings that offer additional terms in an acceptance or written confirmation. And in there they discussed that written or monthly statements of accounts should not be considered. And the main reason is because the contract is over, and secondly, because these are not even usually sent to the same party that negotiated the contract. You may have a buyer in a company that calls up and says, 100 pounds of feed, He may get the invoice that comes in with the goods, but the monthly account goes to the department. Also, the
Before you leave that, Counselor, help me with this. While the monthly statements, as I understand your position, are not a part of the contract, which has already been executed and completed, is there any inconsistency in that and the fact that this is a suit on the sworn account?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Is this a suit on a sworn account?
Yes. I don't believe it is. I believe that a sworn account, I don't believe it is a special kind of contract. I believe it's really just a series of different transactions. Generally, now, I suppose if you go down to the hardware store and pick up some nails and they send you a bill, that's on a sworn account. In the merchant context, it's usual several dealings with a statement at the end of each month or a particular period when the account's due. I don't believe there's any inconsistency. The only, and I think something that's important that I've never heard discussed is what kind of terms are going to be allowed to be inserted unilaterally. Generally, every time there has been litigation, practically, it's been not on the terms of the contract per se, the nature, quality, and kind of goods, but it's been upon what happens after somebody breaches the contract. I think those terms perhaps should be declared to be material and must be expressly agreed upon. I don't have absolutely no authority for that, but that's what, because let's just take a quick look at what kind of terms have caused substantial litigation in Texas, where they tried to be added unilaterally, whether the courts discussed 2.207 or not. In Daniel Brothers versus West Texas Equipment Company, which is not cited in my brief, it's cited in an amicus brief, it's last year, 1979 Amarillo case, the court held that venue provisions added in monthly statements that the buyer has no obligation to object to the effort to add an agreement already in existence. They're just saying it's not fair. Venue is really what happens. You don't have to worry about venue unless there's a default or an argument about the price.
Price on the invoice, frequently invoices that come with goods really don't contain the contract. You know, in this case, where they say anything about how it's payable, what's payable, anything like that?
Yes,
the invoice just shows that it's going to be signed for by some dock foreman and truck driver going to deliver it.
Yes.
It shows what he's giving him, 50 barrels or something.
The invoice in this case merely provided for a charge. And I submit that that was sufficient under the code to lock in the terms of payment.
Well, isn't it customary to have some kind of interest?
I think it's, yes it is. As a matter of fact, our statute provides for it. Our statute provides that, as it existed at that time, that in absence of an agreement, you could have interest at 6% per annum beginning January 1st after the goods were delivered. So, it's exactly right. When those invoices were delivered with charge, that contract was completed. And because the parties had not agreed to an interest rate, the legislature gave them an interest rate.
You get a better grade of invoice than that, and my lawyer got something on that that says what it's going to cost me if I don't pay it in 10 days.
And this may have been a different case had those invoices provided that. But of course, the invoices didn't. This case seems to be particularly in contrast with the case of El Paso Environmental Systems versus Filtronics Incorporated, which is cited in our brief. In that case, the Whitman's refused no reversible error by this court. The El Paso court held simply that the terms added by operation of law or acquiescence could not be the agreement contemplated by Article 5069 1.03. So in other words, when our legislature said the interest rate on open accounts is going to be 6% beginning January 1 next year, unless otherwise agreed, that agreement cannot be by virtue of acquiescence or by operation of law or by some implied because of some silence or whatever. That philosophy is not new to Texas. In an old case, which is not in the brief, Adrians versus Brooks, 13 Texas Reports 279 and 1855 case, the facts in that case are alarmingly similar to this one. What happened was, one of the parties was, it was a suit on a sworn account. The defendant did not deny that he owed the account, but he said, I didn't owe the interest. I didn't agree to any interest. The plaintiff said, well, you must have agreed to interest because you made several goods and several purchases and you paid interest. And the Texas Supreme Court, over 100 years ago, said, no, if interest is such an important thing that we can, charging of interest by contract, written contracts, okay, you can agree to it orally, but we're not going to condone it by somebody just paying a monthly bill. I think that's one fallacy in the arguments of the respondents in this. They say that Ken Vanderhoof agreed to pay this, or is some kind of estoppel or whatever, because he didn't object. The thing is, the testimony uncontradictedly in the statement of facts show that he didn't know the interest was being charged. The fact that he paid monthly payments doesn't mean he acquiesced or agreed to the interest. All he knows is he was making payments on his account.
He would acknowledge that his bookkeeper constitutes knowledge of Mr. Vanderhoof. What's your answer to that?
Oh, I certainly don't think so, not unless the bookkeeper was shown to have had the authority to contract for the corporation, because that's what it is. If there's some modification, because
about his knowledge, not his contract.
Well, still, if his knowledge or his actions, whether it's by silence or act or omission, are going to be imputed to the corporation, he's got to have some authority. So I think I would submit that the same result, the fact that the bookkeeper didn't say, yes, we'll pay interest, the knowledge, I don't see how it would differ from the bookkeeper's authority. How it would make any difference unless the bookkeeper had some kind of authority to bind the corporation.
Well, the bookkeeper knew that the interest was being charged.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the bookkeeper was authorized to make payments. And the bookkeeper did make payments, which included it.
Yes.
I'm just anticipating that the respondent here is going to argue that the fact that they made payments that included those interests made them accept the terms of the statement that had included the statement of interest.
I can appreciate that.
I'm just asking for your response.
Certainly, I see the point.
Well, the bookkeeper didn't have any authority to modify the contract, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm trying to say. Maybe I didn't make it clear.
Modify what contract?
The contract that existed when Ken Vanderhoof called up to Missouri and said, ship me these. The monthly statement wasn't the contract. The monthly statement was just a unilateral status.
I'm sure you've covered this, but a reorder, in the light of what comes that he's going to charge you 12% after 30 days. Is there evidence that he never saw that? Is that what you're saying?
Uncontradicted evidence that he never saw that.
Didn't pay attention to his numbers.
Perhaps, in view of the fact of what happened in this case, he should have, Mr. Vanderhoof's business did not prosper. Maybe he should have kept a closer look on his bus, but the fact that it's uncontroversial is that they didn't know the interest of being charged.
I'm still not still on the question Judge Barrett asked earlier, and maybe the Chief Justice. It now stands, Biozyme has a judgment against Preston Farms Inc. and Mr. Vanderbilt.
Yes, sir.
You're not contending that Preston Farms Inc. could legally pay up to 18% interest. Is that?
We're not, we're saying that the statute regarding corporations says that a corporation may agree to pay interest up to 18%. Similarly, on just open accounts, the statute says that unless otherwise agreed, interest is allowable at 6% beginning January the 1st. The crux of the issue is the same regardless of whether it's a corporation or an individual. You've got to still have an agreement.
You're saying the corporation, when he incorporated, the corporation started ordering this, they are not charged with any knowledge of this 12% on the prior invoice.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that the knowledge of a... question is, did Mr. Vanderhoof have any duty to check the statement? That's really the question.
Well, let's get away from Mr. Vanderhoof now. We all of a sudden got corporations. According to the figures I see here, over half of this $31,000 was sold to the corporation. Are you saying there's no duty, no responsibility on anybody connected to that corporation to ever look at an invoice, to ever determine what the contract is by which they are receiving? Vanderhoof's not getting it anymore. The corporation is getting the fee. And they have no responsibility to look at an invoice, to check with anybody, and go ahead and make a payment every now and then, and they can just ignore that 12% on the invoice and not be charged with it.
Let me help you, though. My wife and I buy stuff from time to time from local clothing stores, and we go in and we buy something at a price that's on the tag, and nothing said about interest. From time to time, merchants, having read the law, send me an agreement that from here on out, you authorize us to charge you 1% a month. I throw them in the wastebasket. I don't agree to any such thing. And we keep on buying things at a price, and we pay the invoice, usually within 30 days, for it. But I consciously don't agree to pay 12%. They can cut off my charge account. But I have not agreed by looking at the invoice to pay 12%. Both ways.
Now that was the situation for both the corporation and Mr. Vanderhoof, as I understand your argument.
Exactly, and not only that, our law provides that if a corporation wants to charge interest at a greater rate than 10% or 6% of no open account, that you can enter into a retail installment contract signed by the partner, and just like you do at Sears or Ward or whatever. That's to protect everybody, because if they're going to charge that much interest, it ought to be in writing. They ought to have give you monthly breakdown of how much is paid and how much was applied to interest and whatever. One thing that I think that's of importance is that the implication of this case certainly transcends Mr. Vanderhoof's problems with Biozyme Enterprises. What's going to happen is that if you can alter a contract by putting additional terms not in invoices, not in confirmatory letters or mailgrams or wiregrams, not anything like that that's accepted and understood in the commercial trade, but in monthly statements. And remember, in this statement, the monthly charges were not imposed until months after they could have been imposed. We've got two courts of civil appeals opinions that said they're not charging.
Wait, finish your sentence, Captain.
Well, we got two Court of Civil Appeals opinion that says the mere notation, or the more mere legend, that interest can be charged or is going to be charged is not sufficient. But that is not a charging under a usury law until the charge is actually imposed.
That's on the state.
Yes.
Not on him.
On the state. Yes. So how can the, if it's not a charging by the merchant, how can it be an agreement by the person?
All right, thank you. Court, take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.
First, I'd like to state briefly the history of this case, the facts. Basically, this was a case on sworn account filed by Bioline because Preston Farm and Ranch and Mr. Vanderhoof had not paid approximately $31,000 of their bill on account. This is just the unpaid portion. There were portions paid during their approximately 1 year of time doing business with each other. I believe because of that, I can't really argue with counsel's point that Mr. Vanderhoof didn't read his mail because it appears he didn't read his bills either. I would like to address the point first that the Chief Justice makes about going into an agreement, buying some merchandise at Sears or some other place of that type, and then getting an invoice in the mail with some terms on it. I agree with the Chief Justice's point that that certainly is a situation where, one, a consumer can throw away the bill and ignore it. However, here...
I don't throw away the bill. I throw away the stuff I'm going to sign like an arm and a leg and my mother if I don't pay you.
I understand that. And it's our point that that is a different type of agreement because that's a consumer transaction. And consumers are protected differently than transactions between merchants. In this case, we have a transaction between Biozyme, who is a wholesaler of farm products of feed and fertilizer, and Ken Vanderhoof and Preston Farm and Ranch, who is a retailer of farm products, who was reselling these products. It's a completely different situation than a consumer, and it is governed by express statute passed by the legislature in the state, the Texas Business and Commerce Code, which is the adoption of the UCC. The UCC section 2.207 governs these types of transactions. 2.207 states that unless notification of an objection is given within a reasonable time or is already given, that some additional terms can be incorporated into a contract between merchants. And the official comment, as Judge Spears points out, specifically mentions interest charge to be one of these. Biozyme would also like to point out further down in section 2.207, it states that conduct by both parties which recognizes the existence of a contract is sufficient to establish a contract for sale, although the writings of the party do not otherwise establish a contract.
Counsel, how do you explain the cases that say that that doesn't apply, the terms that are unilaterally offered after the contract's already been consummated and performed?
Your Honor, in this case, these terms were not offered after the contract had already been consummated and performed. At the time the invoice was sent, it just merely stated charge. Several weeks after that, on the monthly billing, it came out and the exact terms of this charge were given to Ken Vanderhoof and Preston Farm and Ranch. And I don't think it's the contention of the petitioner herein that they never received these invoices. There is uncontradicted evidence that these invoices were received, but Mr. Vanderhoof testifies at trial that, well, he never looked at them. He never paid much attention to them. He thinks they were being paid. He doesn't understand how they were, how exactly they were paid. Your Honors, I submit that that is certainly an argument without merit. In the business world today, it is not always the principal of the business that handles all the transactions. Would Mr. Vanderhoof also argue if he wasn't on the loading dock to accept these feeds and fertilizers and somebody else signed for them that they too could not sign for them and accept goods? I think not. I think that's entirely a specious argument. The other thing that's of importance...
That's a little strong. Somebody on a loading dock can make a contract receive the goods and sign the terms and conditions and interest rates, is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that somebody on the loading dock can accept the goods for the company. Now, the company or the person who runs the company should have knowledge of what these terms are, and it is because he is a merchant, he's specifically required by the UCC to pay attention to his business, and if there are differing terms, to bring it to the attention of the supplier. Your Honor, in this case, we had a course of business that dealt over a year with some 24 different shipments, and not at one time did Mr. Vanderhoof, or later Preston Foreman Ranchi, ever complain, ever say that you're charging me interest. He was given records that certain money that he was paying was going towards these interest charges, and not once did he ever complain over this whole course of dealing. And, Your Honors, I believe that is why Section 2.207 was enacted, to look at the conduct of the parties. Look at the conduct. Mr. Vanderhoof and Preston Foreman Rank was accepting this merchandise, was reselling, was being billed for the goods with these specific charge terms. That's the course of conduct. And it wasn't until after Biozyme not being paid for the merchandise that was shipped, not until after the case had already been filed, that Mr. Vanderhoof and Preston Foreman Ranch come up with the theory of usury.
But counsel, without trying to be conveyed in disrespect, I don't think you answered my question. And that was, can the statements on or terms unilaterally put on a statement that is sent days, even weeks after the goods are ordered and delivered, create terms? Is that the sort of terms that this Section 2.207 was designed to cover?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And what we have to look at is both the terms on the invoice and the terms on the monthly statements. And as the Court of Civil Appeals correctly held, that the term on the invoice, which came at the time the goods arrived, which was the acceptance of the contract with additional terms, said charge.
That's all it said.
All it said was charge. Now, at the point, a few weeks later, when the terms came out, it was incorporated into those terms. Whether it was at the time or whether it was 3 weeks later, it was something because Mr. Vanderhoof did not complain, did not ask any information about the charge, as is in the record, that those terms meshed together and became terms of the charge at the time the goods were accepted, therefore becoming additional terms of the contract pursuant to the UCC.
And the terms set out weeks after the goods were accepted meshed with the phrase charge that was on the invoice and the order and acceptance and the delivery and all that became part of the contract weeks after?
Yes, Your Honor, because by Ken Vanderhoof, a merchant, accepting goods with the legend charge, meaning that you're accepting goods and we are putting this on our charge plan, and not questioning the charge plan, not saying, no, I object to being put on any kind of charge plan, and just several weeks later finding out about the charge plan, and still at that point not objecting, Your Honor, it shows the whole course of conduct with the parties, the course of dealing, was that Mr. Vanderhoof agreed from the very beginning to be put on this charge plan.
You think charge and charge plan are synonymous? Just by saying charge, you agree to charge, and you normally charge something, you don't think about other terms. Just charge it.
Yes, Your Honor, and...
You don't have to pay it, but...
Yes, Your Honor, and because we're dealing in a situation between merchants, we're not dealing with consumers. We're not dealing with somebody that signs a pennies agreement and gets a said charge and that's it. We're dealing with merchants who are, by the UCC, the Texas Business and Commerce Code, are charged with the knowledge of carrying on as a merchant. And that is the reason why 2.207 is enacted, to codify the fact that dealing with merchants, it's different than dealing with consumers. There are different papers that go back and forth. There's different requirements and responsibilities. And I think that the point would be well taken if, at the time Mr. Vanderhoof got the invoice, that he said, my gosh, this is, you know, a charge completely different than I expected, called up and said it couldn't relate back because I didn't ever know about this, but that didn't happen. Because of the acquiescence and because of the silence and because of the course of dealings between these two parties for an entire year, that it can be assumed that this was part of the contract, and it is not an implied part of the contract, but it is a part of the contract that specifically is provided for by Section 2.207. And Biozyne believes that there's language to the effect that, well, this was an implied contract between the parties. This is certainly not correct. It's a contract by operation of law, just as the usury statute 5069.1.03 on interest said that it's also implied by law that if there's no agreement, that the interest rate at the time was 6% after January 1st of the next year. That also is the same type of implied agreement by law, and therefore neither one can take precedence over the other. They're both laws passed by the legislature and laws that the courts must use equally to decide whether a contract was entered into or not.
Counselor, were these invoices that were delivered at the time the goods were delivered, were they priced, extended, and told, or just a description of the goods on them?
Your Honor, I believe there was just a description of the goods on them with the alleged charge.
Would it make any difference? Is there any significance in the fact that this was an ongoing, repetitive type situation as opposed to a one-time charge? And putting notice on the buyer at the end of the show.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would be a great difference and a very important difference, especially in light of the language of 2.207 that says conduct by both parties which recognizes a contract. And in this particular case, the conduct of the parties was that goods were being delivered, goods were being paid for, goods were being put on the charge card, the charge account, some approximately 22 sales over a year period. It would seem to Biozyne that Mr. Vanderhoof and Preston Farm Ranch coming before this court and saying we knew nothing about these charges, and because we knew nothing about them, not only should we not pay the interest, but we should not pay the principal that we owe, and we should get penalties also. Now, the law at the time has changed a great deal, and the law back at that time is the law that this case should be decided. I believe there is some confusion over the recent case of El Paso Filtronics. In that case, the court, in an opinion which is dicta, stated that to overcome the law on usury and interest, there must be a written agreement. Now, Your Honors, Biozyne submits that one that was just dicta in that ruling because the court went on to hold that because of the pleading that they could not hold usury in that case. And Your Honor, Biozyme also submits that that is just a wrong interpretation of 5069.1.03. If I may read to the court, 5069.1.03 states specifically, when no specified rate of interest is agreed upon by the parties, and then lists two separate examples. One, interest at the rate of 6% per annum shall be allowed on all written contracts, ascertaining the sum payable from and after the time when the sum is due and payable. And two, and on all open accounts from the first day of January after the same are made. Your Honors, Biozyme submits that 5069.1.03 to not come into effect only takes an agreement, does not take a written agreement, as the El Paso court has previously held in their dicta opinion.
Counsel, you make it appear, maybe I help, that it's all the fault of the buyer for not reading his mail. Would it be asking too much of merchants?
With respect to whether there exists an adequate alternative remedy at law, the majority indicates that the traditional appellate process embodies such. However, an appeal necessarily requires a trial of the charge of the condition precedent. The whole purpose of the Speedy Trial Act is to remedy inexcusable delay with the dismissal of the charges with prejudice. Thus, any remedy according one deprived of the rights created under chapter 32A is too little, too late, and therefore an inadequate alternative to remedy. Judge Phillips in his dissent and concurred in the Arduino case, speaking exactly on that point and the point that we're talking about. Texas legislature made the law of the offense that this man is charged with. In other words, they passed the law that if he's guilty of stealing, he's going to be charged with it, or any citizen, and that case is going to come on to trial. The same Texas legislature, maybe not the same members, but the same Texas legislature passed the law that he's entitled to benefit from the Speedy Trial Act. And now we're here saying, in effect, that the Class C misdemeanor can't be heard because of the fact that he has an appeal that's an adequate remedy of law. The point is that point, in my opinion, would not be again reviewed in the county court's law as to whether or not he had adequate remedy of law. It would require him to go to the county court's law after the second trial in the justice court and then to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And we're talking about...
Counselor, your time is up.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. The argument from...
Sometimes I'm afraid that our outlying justice to see existence in this case is in a little community about 14 miles from north of Waco. And I think sometimes we do Xerox copies of the complaint, perhaps the ticket. But in response to these various questions, yes, and the appeal bond itself, when it comes in and is filed, will show that a conviction was out on certain dates. The prior